Philomena Kunk, the UK's queen of deadpan satire. She's made you laugh and cringe. And now there's a podcast all about this TV icon, Kunked, a very unofficial podcast. That's C-U-N-K-D on all podcast platforms. Kunked covers the brilliantly awkward world of Philomena Kunk, hosted by a razor-sharp Brit and a witty American who unpack every ridiculous moment with clever commentary and cultural banter. If you love Philomena Kunk satire, absurdity, and laughing till it hurts, Kunked is for you. So be sure to check out Kunked on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and wherever you listen to podcasts. Kunked, start listening right now.
You are now listening to The Scheist Podcast, when millions of opinions just aren't enough.
Hello again, and surprise! Back for two episodes in one day. It's not common, but every now and then it happens, and I was able to convince Kristen to come back in studio and join me for a long overdue this week slash technically this month at the movies, and we obviously have a lot to go through because it's been a while, so we're going to be talking about Final Destination, Bloodlines, Lilo and Stitch, Mission Impossible, Final Reckoning, The Life of Chuck, Materialist, F1 the Movie, Bring Her Back, Tornado, 28 Years Later, Ballerina, The Unholy Trinity, and The Phoenician Scheme. Whew. Okay, so I usually like to say things are spoiler light around here, so keep that in mind and join us for this week at the movies for June 29th, 2025. Hello, welcome back to this 2 months, this month or so and some change. Yeah, at the movies. It's many, many monthos. I don't know. It's been a while. When did Final Destination come out? I think we saw that opening weekend.
No, saw that late, I'm pretty sure.
Well, then don't listen to me. We saw Lilo and Stitch opening weekend, right?
It was like that following week, which was Memorial Day weekend, I think.
Okay, so
we saw it the week after, I think.
Memorial Day was in May?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
almost
it's been
July.
Yeah, it's been some months, but we are here, and we're back to chat a little bit about these movies. We've got 6 on deck. Hopefully in order that we saw them, but definitely way behind the curve. And
so we don't need to worry about spoilers.
Well, yeah, probably not. We'll just chat. And I mean, we did see F1, which just came out, so I wouldn't want to spoil that for people. Yeah. But it's about cars. Shocking.
Maybe it's Formula One.
Right, Formula One. So we've got some chit-chat to get to, so let's just jump right into it with the Final Destination Bloodlines.
Okay.
I've heard mixed things about it. It has a 6.9, though, on IMDb and a 73 Metascore, so that's higher than I've heard from some people, but I think, at least from what I've seen, most people liked it. I did have a friend who said he thought it was the worst movie he's ever seen.
Really?
But also, I think tonally, like, if you think it's a horror movie, I guess, if you want to be scared, it's not the movie for it.
I mean, if you haven't seen any of the other Final Destinations, maybe.
Well, yeah,
but it was on par, I feel like, with the Final Destination universe.
Yeah, well, we had that conversation, I think, right after the movie was like, were the other ones comedies? Because I remember the first one at least took itself semi-seriously, and I think as the series got a little bit longer in the tooth and needed to do things a little bit differently, the whole point of the franchise was not like to scare you at that point, but was to rather engage in
greater and greater sort of like ridiculous deaths, you know? So I think like as a fan of horror movies that aim to scare you, I already didn't expect that from the series, right? I mean, or not from the series, but from this movie. So I wasn't going into it like, oh yeah, if this movie fails to scare me, it's going to be sort of a failure in general. Instead, I kind of was just like, eh, do you want to see this? It's out. We'll see what happens. And like, it's really funny. And it's intentionally funny for a lot of it. Like, a dude gets folded in half, magnetized by his like dick and nipple rings. So like, the movie knows that it's funny. And so I think maybe for somebody who is a little bit too rigid about their horror taste, then that's not going to fall into the category of movies that are aiming to scare you.
Yeah, I feel like this doesn't fall under a traditional horror movie for me, at least. It's more like gore horror.
Yeah.
But not scary horror. I know horror is like a very large genre. I think this could be a little psychological, because even like we were both saying shortly after.
Driving home, I was like, oh God, every single thing. Double people like
cutting us off.
Yeah, horrible drivers trying to final destination us.
Yeah, so like that mentality around like the doing it to us component, I think is like a psychological horror versus, which can be scary, but versus like a, I guess what you would say is a run-of-the-mill horror movie.
Yeah,
as far as the scare goes.
I feel like in terms of genre, horror has become probably as big and as adaptable as sci-fi, if not more so. There's a bunch of different styles that you can apply to that genre. There's a bunch of subgenres within the genre, and you can use sort of the idea of genre filmmaking to do something more than the limitations of the genre. I mean, you see directors like Ari Aster right now sort of taking horror films, but really pushing them into like a very emotional and psychological place, which is not like completely unique to him. This was done in the past with certain types of horror movies, but to have it be mainstream and to have him be one of those names, or like Robert Eggers with the way he, you know, did Nosferatu, or the way he did The Witch, sort of leaning a lot more heavily on the entire sort of craft of filmmaking to be, I don't want to say elevated, because that sounds like a little too cliche from what I've heard, like elevated horror, but I feel like that's kind of what it is, like treating a horror, like when you go into making a horror movie, treating it like you're making a movie that is as serious as something that would compete for Best Picture or something like that, right? Treating it with the same level of intent and respect, which when you're making 7th, 8th sequel in a horror franchise, I don't know that you're doing that kind of thing. And Final Destination obviously is aware that they are not doing that. So I don't hold that against them. And I had a fun time. I'm glad that I see audiences and critics seem to pretty much understand what the movie is.
Yeah. I mean, I had fun with it. I liked the original. Like, I kind of want to go back and rewatch the first and the second one. It's been a while, but I think at the time, especially when the first one came out, and like, I think it was around the time of like Urban Legends.
The 2000s era horror stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. They were kind of like, for me at least, they were different kinds of horror movies versus like the Screams and I Know What You Did Last Summers and, you know, even the Friday the 13th or whatever, you know, that we kind of grew up with. And it was scary to me at the time, but I kind of didn't expect that going into this. And maybe just because fast forward 20 plus years for us in age, but I didn't have expectations for this and I had fun with it.
Yeah. So did I. Seemed like the audience had fun too. So yeah. Good times. All right. Well, let's move on to Lilo and Stitch, because that was one that you put put us in the theater for.
I still want to rewatch it. I'm looking forward to it coming to Disney Plus and watching it at home again. I've heard a lot of complaints about it and it not being as good as the original, or leaving certain things out of the original, or not being happy with certain things being changed. And maybe it's just because for the longest time I didn't realize this was a remake of the original. I just thought, like, not that it was necessarily a brand new story of Lilo and Stitch, but I just looked at it as like, okay, it's the first time they're doing Lilo and Stitch live action. It's fine that it's its own movie. I loved it despite the horrible experience we had in the movie theater, but that's why I say I want to see it again, because I feel like we actually missed a lot because we couldn't hear the lines. I loved the little girl that played Lilo. I thought they did a good job with Stitch.
Yeah.
The supporting cast was really good. One of the actors actually recently passed from that movie. But I wasn't disappointed, and I've heard a lot of disappointment. But again, I feel like you're always going to be set up for disappointment if you go into a movie expecting it to be exactly the same. And like I said, I know it was a remake of the original and it was supposed to be like the exact same movie. But we fast forward them doing this remake. This came out also like mid-2000s maybe. So it's been over 10 or 15 years maybe since the original came out. And unless you have this capacity to constantly rewatch the first one, I felt like I at least was far enough away from the original to not be upset by any little changes. I think they hit like some of the priority original marks of it. So I mean, I was happy with it. I loved it. Again, minus the theater experience of it, which did taint it a little bit, but still in hindsight, like talking about it now, I still have like, I love the movie memories. Not like, it's not at the front of my brain of how horrible the movie theater experience part was.
Well, you are lucky to have that.
At least not to taint the movie for me.
Yeah, no, I get that. I was between you and them. So maybe that gave you that barrier of separation, because before I get into that, I want to say that the movie's got a 6.9 IMDb, 53 Metascore. So critics didn't like it, but fine with audiences. I'm sure it made an ass ton of money. It looks like, it made almost $1 billion worldwide. So not really surprising there. But we had a family of, I want to say, six.
I think it was actually two families.
It might have been two families with kids, but we had a group of six with all of them in Stitch outfits.
Which like was really cute when
onesies,
we first got there.
Rompers, whatever. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's so cute. And then they were the most unruly and inconsiderate people that maybe I've ever sat next to in a movie theater. Agree.
Even for a kids movie.
Yeah. The kids could not sit still at all. The parents had no interest in trying to get them to calm down. In fact, they just let them run around the movie theater.
They had AirPods in their ears.
The parents, yes. The young lady sitting next to me had AirPods in and was occasionally just having her phone out and recording and taking pictures of the screen while the kid on her lap screamed, yelled, spilled popcorn. It looked like a war zone after they left. And then that kid who was climbing all over her on the recliner ended up falling off the recliner, smacking their head on the ground, and then crying bloody murder. So, it was a really, really horrible.
And they didn't take the kid out.
They didn't take the kid out when the kid was crying. They didn't try to do anything to sort of like pacify the situation at all. So it was really sad, because clearly the kids didn't care enough about the movie to actually really be there. Like, they're all wearing Stitch costumes. I'm sure they watched the animated version at home and they love it and stuff, but like, they didn't actually give a shit about being there. Like, they weren't even watching the movie for the most part. So just, and the parents, like, they didn't care either. So, like, why even be there at that point is my question.
And that's a lot of money to spend.
With snacks? Fuck yeah, it is.
Without actually having any care for the movie.
I mean, that's always
my
thing. They
also were running around the entire theater, poking their head between people's seats.
Yeah.
Running up and down the aisles, like... Okay, so if you want to treat it as like free childcare, even though no one's taking care of your children, that's still very expensive and not free childcare.
No, it's not. I mean, between the snacks and the ticket price, I mean, they're probably in the hole for $100.
Oh, way more.
Yeah. I mean, I bought a soda and popcorn when we went to the movies last night. And it was $20. So there's no way that they got off for like less than $65 probably to have snacks and stuff for all of them. But it is a bigger issue. And it's like, I get that it's a kid's movie, right? Like, we went and saw Inside Out 2, right? We didn't have that issue.
No.
You know, we went and saw Moana in theaters. We didn't have Moana 2 in theaters. Didn't have that issue.
Look, I've seen a lot of kid movies in theaters, especially with my nieces and nephews growing up for years. And I've never had that experience in a movie theater with kids, for a kid movie specifically.
Yeah. So, you know, when people talk about the theatrical business model dying, it's like,
that's why.
Of course it is. Like, there's no decorum in the theater. And on the one hand, you know, I don't want to be the person who sort of polices how you're allowed to interact with art, right? So I don't want to be like, oh, you have to watch the movie the way that I watch it. I would just want you to sort of observe the communal rules of the experience. And I think having your phone out and recording the movie is like, you're not even there. But like, same thing when we go to a concert, right? Like, I'm staring through a sea of cell phones. It's like, I'm not on my phone recording, watching through my phone. I'm just trying to enjoy the concert. And so kind of like this same deal, basically. And I don't want to be like, oh, man, like, people are just like so sort of ill behaved and don't really have any kind of like tact or decorum anymore. And it just seems like it's getting more and more that direction. So what's happening is like people like me who really like the movie theater experience and other sort of
to be distraction free for a reason.
Yeah, I don't want to call myself a cinephile because I feel like that's a dirty word that I don't like. But as someone who really loves the experience of going to the movie theater and just like being in the dark and having the communal experience, it's becoming less and less accessible for us. And I'm the kind of person that goes and sees a ton of movies. I'm not just there for like the one big release that weekend. Like, I go and see a bunch of stuff. So it's definitely different based on the type of movie that you're going to. But I was joking online on social media saying that I need to start a new list of movies where like I'm knee deep in the emotional throes of the film and the person next to me is looking at Instagram, because that happened in back to back movies.
It happens in every movie we go to.
Yeah. I'm just like, at that point, like, why are you even there? Like, what? If Instagram is more interesting to you than what you're watching on the screen, like, just like, leave the theater. Don't be there. It doesn't make sense to me to be in a movie theater paying to have this experience, to see something on the big screen, to like not actually be there. Like, it is cost prohibitive at that point. I guess maybe the influx of A-list and subscription models and stuff like that have changed how people feel about it, right? Because we went to the movies and I had bought tickets, and then when we got there, it was like, oh, these seats are empty. So somebody just canceled because the cancellation fee is free. They didn't have to worry about any of that stuff. So it's very disposable versus like, oh, we paid the ticket price. We have to leave the house. We have to go. We have to be on time. And it's like, you know, how many times do we go to the movie theater and someone's sitting in our seat?
Almost every time.
Yeah, especially at AMCs. So
I think also, though, like, we've done it before where maybe you book tickets before you can like talk to me about it. And I'm like, oh, I actually see this time and I prefer this time. Yeah. So you cancel and rebook for another theater or another time.
Oh, yeah, that happens for sure. But like, we don't go to the theater and just be like, well, let's sit in the seats that aren't ours and hope that people don't show up. It's like, no, we're going to sit in our seats. And then if we really want to move and the movie's going on, we can just like move because these people are obviously not showing up. It's, you know, half an hour into the movie. So at that, but we still don't do that most of the time.
Yeah. What was the movie we saw before? I think it was Before We Traveled or something, where we should have moved and we didn't because of an unruly kid. Oh. And it wasn't a kid movie.
No, it was something.
It was at Regal.
It was something at Regal, and they sat behind us and they like would not shut up the whole time. And again, parents didn't care, kicking the back of our seats. Like, so yeah, I don't blame people who just wait to see things at home. Like, I really don't. And like, I feel bad for theater owners because for the most part, like, the theater owner isn't in it to provide the type of environment where the disruption is common. But because those types of movies are the ones that are going to be the meal tickets, like, you kind of have to allow that behavior. And unfortunately, there's not like an Alamo Drafthouse that's close enough to us to make it worthwhile to make that my primary theater, where they're very strict about phones and stuff like that.
You know what I miss? ArcLight used to be strict because they used to do very minimal previews. They would come out and talk to you before it, and they had someone specifically go in and out of the theater to check to make sure people were staying off their phones and being quiet multiple times through the movie at ArcLight. And that experience doesn't exist either anymore because now that ArcLight is a Regal.
Yeah. I mean, I guess just like observationally, right? Like, if you are going to get a movie ticket and go to a movie and then just not pay attention, like, I think that's a bigger concern, not for the movie theater, but for like the movie business in general, because people don't treat it as something to be patient and respectful of. They view it as content that they can view and ignore at their leisure. And so, yeah, of course, like, movies are going to be in trouble because of that. And I don't know if that does ever get fixed unless you sort of like, these are 21 and over screenings kind of thing, where kids are allowed.
Yeah, but these are mostly adults doing it.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely adults who are huge violators of it. And it's super annoying. It's like, do you really have to check your phone every 10 minutes to look at Instagram, like, while you're sitting here? Like, you have a seat directly in the middle. Like, you pick the best seat in the movie theater to sit here and look at your phone. It's
we're having a full text conversation.
Yeah. I mean, at least, like, the people who are the best violators are the people who understand, like, they're going to put their screen brightness down, or they have one of those. All phones should come with the privacy thing where it's like, if you're not looking at it head on, you can't see it kind of thing. Because if you have that, then I wouldn't even know. I'd see you fidgeting or whatever, which is, you know, its own thing. But lots of phone violations, which it makes it annoying to go to the movies. And as much as I love going, this is why I try to go during the afternoon. Like, I'll take a break from work and go for like 2 hours in the afternoon.
Yeah. So did you not like Lilo and Stitch?
I don't even know. I feel like I liked it fine, but
I was
so annoyed that my level of enjoyment was always going to be capped. But I mean, from what I saw, I was like, yes, the little girl, Kaya, is that her name? She was very, very good. Maya. And Sydney Agudong was also good as Nani.
Nani.
Yeah, they were good. Like, Stitch was cute. Like, it was fun and ruckus and all that. But, like, also Stitch is a huge troublemaker that, like, doesn't listen. So if the kids, like, love that, then, of course, they're going to do the same thing. So I liked it fine. I don't know that I would watch it again voluntarily. It's not that kind of movie for me, but.
But would you watch it again to see if you're feel for the movie changed being in a different environment?
In theory, that is a good experiment. However, there's other things that I would rather dedicate my time to, and it would not be a high priority for me to do that, because I don't think the level of enjoyment would be shifted dramatically.
Okay.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Galifianakis and What's-His-Face were also good as the weird aliens, Billy Magnussen. You know, they were fun. There's a lot of good things about the movie, but the experience itself was abysmal.
Yeah.
So we went from that to Mission Impossible. Final Reckoning, maybe.
No, there's going to be more.
Penultimate Reckoning.
You cannot take Tom Cruise out of the Mission Impossible universe.
You can take Tom Cruise out of the Mission Impossible universe, but you can't take Tom Cruise out of the movies.
No, I think you can't take the Mission Impossible universe out of Tom Cruise.
Yeah, that's a better way to say it. I mean, if it's not Mission Impossible, it's going to be something else. I mean, he did, you know, Minority Report. He did Oblivion. He did, it's not called Die Another Day. It's that one, though. Live, Die, Repeat. That's not it either. Edge of Tomorrow. That's the one. He did those three movies while Mission Impossible was all happening sort of in the background. So he's going to do some sort of like spectacle film.
War of the Worlds too.
I think it was a little before. No. Yeah, that was during the Mission Impossible. I mean, Mission Impossible has been going since like the late 90s. So it's been running. And while it was entertaining in its best moments, in its less than best moments, it was kind of pretty average. I like the one before this better. Dead Reckoning, right? Yeah.
Is that the one with the train?
Yeah, I like that one better, and I still didn't love that one that much. I was like, it's a lot funnier than I expected that one to be, and they had some good stunts in that one, too. It is the one where they're on the train, yeah. So, yeah, I don't have a lot to say about it. Like, the airplane scene is obviously amazing.
Tom Cruise and his airplane scenes.
Yeah, I mean, it's... Like, I'm of two minds about it, because on the one hand, it felt very sort of corny throughout much of the movie, which, whatever, if it wants to do that as like a send off to say like goodbye and thank you to all the fans who've watched it for all the time, like, I'm okay with that. And then you have like these big set piecing moments of like the submarine and the missiles and him underwater and all that, and like that looks amazing, and then the plane stuff is incredible, and I'm just watching it like, this is the kind of sort of movie magic where I'm like, it's really nuts. Like, I can't believe this is actually on screen, and that like he would do that. There's like a scene where they zoom in on his face and he's like, he can't close his mouth, and his like face is just flapping in the wind, and like, I'm laughing at that, and I think it's intentionally sort of comical in that moment, because it's like, this is just insane. Like, you're sort of just taken aback by the sheer insanity of the performance of the stunt itself. And, you know, for that, I feel like the movie's high point is very high. But, like, I think it's average is far lower than that. But still, like, gave me one of maybe the best scenes I've ever seen in a movie, and I'm fine with that. I had a fun time with it.
Yeah, it was fun.
I just don't have a ton to say about it, because are they coming back? Who knows?
Probably.
I think they tried to be really emotional in some of the moments, and it works a little bit, but best I could say is that it's pitchy. You know, like, there are moments where, like, it hits the high note, and you're like, whoa, that's amazing. And then it's like, oh, they're a little scratchy there and some of the lower tones maybe, but
yeah. Well,
yeah, overall a good experience. We went with your mom. Did she really enjoy it? I don't even remember.
I think she did. She's been rewatching all the other Mission Impossible since, so.
So probably, yeah.
There's a few she said she didn't remember seeing, so yeah, I think she liked it a lot. But she doesn't go to the movies often, so, and she loves Tom Cruise.
Yeah. So even up until that point when we had seen Mission Impossible, I think for me it had not been a great cinematic year. I felt like there's a lot of movies I didn't like early in the year, which is not common for me. I typically like most things, but for me it was like Sinners and Friendship were, I think, head and shoulders above the rest of the competition for my liking, and so nothing had really like scratched that level until recently. And then I'm like, okay, I think whatever's going on, like, the door's open. I'm kind of on a heater right now. I feel like maybe the year has found its footing and I've gotten some more stuff that I really, really enjoy. And I think the one that started that off was Life of Chuck.
Yeah, I feel like this happens every year, though, because it's like once we get past the midway point of the year, we get closer to, like, people are paying attention for Oscar purposes.
Yeah, I think we're still like a little early for that, but, you know,
But anything from here on out is going to be memorable versus something that came out in January.
Well, because I think once May hits,
it's like the holiday movie pushes,
and then then summer comes after, so you're getting a lot of big sort of blockbustery type movies that are meant to be event cinema, and then in the wake of people going to the theaters, you're getting some other stuff. And Life of Chuck is not a summer blockbuster movie. It's not really a movie that probably has made very much money at all. But it's holding on to a 7.7 from IMDb and a 67 Metascore, directed by Mike Flanagan, which he adapted a Stephen King story for this. And yeah, it's grossed $5 million, $7.8 worldwide. So, I mean, I don't even see the budget, but I can guarantee the movie cost more than $8 million to make. So it was always going to sort of be one of those movies, but it's one that I didn't know anything other than the poster I had seen of Tom Hiddleston sort of like mid dance move. And, you know, Hiddleston's not really in the movie that much, but
he's not even narrating it.
He's not. No. Nick Offerman narrates, which is a weird choice. And there's a lot of the times where the narration is kind of off-putting. And I was struggling to figure out like whether or not I liked the movie. And then the more I watched it, the more I liked it. I really liked the first act better than the other two, but also because I think there was some stylistic choices being made in that part of the film that made it more interesting to me. But then it really begins to be a lot more sentimental after that. And it's very earnest in its sentiment. And like the first act of the movie is all basically sort of about like this fear and despair that I think a lot of people are feeling about sort of like the end of the world, right? You know, so I feel like there hasn't been a movie that really captured that sort of like general feeling about the end of the world in the way that it's expressed in this film, and how that just like sort of permeates everybody's life and changes the way you live. I mean, we talked to my sister about this last night of like, how do you plan for a future when it seems like the world is ending? How do you have hopes? How do you have dreams? How do you have goals when it seems like the world's about to collapse? Yeah. So it definitely like seeps into you. And I feel like this movie addresses it in a way that not a lot of other movies maybe have, or at least not ones that I've seen. And there's a conversation that Matthew Lillard is having with Chiwetel Ejiofor during kind of like awareness of like the collapse. And it's like, oh, there was like, I think they said there's like an earthquake and like California was gone kind of thing. So like that kind of end of the world stuff. And their conversation kind of about the end of the world is very like, they're not panicked. They're not really like crying. Like it's just very sort of shocked behavior. Like they're in shock where they like almost can't believe it's happening. They don't know how to act. Like, what do you do at that point? Do you go to work? Like, who knows? And so that idea of like this general kind of despair and fear of the future is like what sets the tone for the movie. And then it gets into the individual sort of life story of a different character and takes you on the progress of that story, and you learn about their childhood and why certain things matter. So it balances like this horrible feeling with also this very like life affirming message that like even in the face of the end of the world, when you're feeling as shitty as possible, life is still worth living. There's still really beautiful things to be had in life. And I think that to me was what sort of as a whole, like the more I thought about it after the movie ended, the more I really enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot to be said too about they're kind of just living in the moment because there's nothing they can do to change it or control it. So they're just as even if there's maybe some fear or panic below the surface, they're just also kind of savoring what they have in the moment.
Yeah. I because it's like, yeah, you're faced with sort of the end and like, how do you spend the end? What do you want to do with that?
When you know it's coming. And I think that's actually kind of not necessarily at everyone's age that they are in the movie, but it is kind of a gift because a lot of people don't know when it's about to be the end for them. And so this gives you kind of a different perspective of like, being more intentional or just thoughtful around how would you want to spend your days and your time if they're limited or when they, I mean, technically they're all limited for us, right? But when you know, like, there's an end date, you can be more intentional about it too.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sentiment. Yeah, and I think it's communicated well in the film, and I hope more people get to see it because I doubt it's in theaters right now, but hopefully more people will begin to come around to it as they get a chance to see it. I think at the time that I saw it, like, I wasn't sure where I would sort of categorize it for myself in the year, because it's like, I think there's definitely some, I don't want to say weaknesses, but in terms of like the strengths that I see in the movies that I would say are like the high level films, like it maybe doesn't hit those high marks in the way that some others do, but its heart is very big. And it reminded me a lot actually of 9 Days, which I don't remember if you saw that with me, but it's sort of about a guardian of sort of like life and death who he auditions like new spirits before they get placed into human bodies. And he has to choose like which person is going to get the chance to be alive. And it's a very, very interesting film in that way. And it's shot on a very small budget. So very, very, I think it's Edson Oda.
I don't remember.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw it with me, but I do like that movie quite a bit. I actually should have nominated that when we did our film club's 2020 movies. It's 2020 on the nose. Yeah, it's Oda. That's a good one. But moving on, we saw Materialists, which I thought was hilarious. I don't know about you.
Hilarious?
Yeah, it was funny.
I mean, it definitely had its funny moments. I definitely cried. It had its heavy moments. But I mean, I really enjoyed it. I like Dakota Fanning. I love
Dakota Johnson.
I mean, Dakota Johnson.
Dakota Fanning's fine too.
Dakota Fanning's great. I like Dakota Johnson. I like Chris Evans. I like Pedro Pascal. Like, the cast was phenomenal. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think it hits on kind of what the dating world experiences these days in real time. Not that we know, luckily, but from what we've heard from people.
Mm-hmm. Others.
Others that are going through it, essentially. I think I'm actually, without, I don't know about the spoiler, but I had read about a surprising theme that was in the movie that was not part of any trailers, obviously.
No.
And I was not upset by that being portrayed because I think a lot of, like, it's very realistic.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of these kind of like fun rom-com matchmaker, like trying to find love movies, never address that. And it's something that's very prevalent in general. But yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting follow-up to Past Lives from Celine Song, because Past Lives is so emotionally wrought with tension and history. And obviously, I mean, it's in the title, like it's about sort of your past and the difficulties in sort of distancing yourself from it and what happens when sort of it becomes your present again, and all of the complications of that. And in this movie, like, even like it says here, feel good romance, where I would not say that this is a feel good romance film. I feel like in looking at it, it's very, very kind of basic rom-com structure, in that rich guy, poor guy, choose rich life, choose poor life. One has love, one doesn't, but one doesn't have like all the pain of being poor. Not entirely unfamiliar in the world of romantic storytelling, both in literature and on the screen. So
yeah,
the setup is kind of basic, but what she does is she takes Dakota Johnson's character and basically turns her into like the very annoying alpha male type of character that's like, it's all math and it's all numbers and like dating is a marketplace and your stock is this because of your height and your income and all that. So
it's a business deal.
It is. Yeah. So what's funny is I felt like the way that she portrays what the character does is sort of like a very nihilistic worldview. And I'm like, I'm actually kind of okay with that. Because the movie, when it's in that mode, has, I think, the awareness and the sense of humor in the writing to make the nihilism, like, on paper, it makes sense what she's saying. But in actuality, when we see the interactions, it's, like, laughably stupid. And so despite the character, like, basically, like, writing a, you know, a research paper on why certain relationships will work and not, and why like income and height and all these things matter. It's like, yeah, everything she's saying sort of makes sense and adds up and works for her job as a matchmaker. But every time we see her interact with these people, like it's always stupid. It's every single time. It was like hilariously stupid. So on the one hand, like it gave, I feel like it gave Celine Song the opportunity to really have fun and go to like the darkest place of sort of not believing in love and really just like play in that sandbox, but then also sort of call back on the strength of what Past Lives was, which is sort of like a shared history. And then even though it's choppy and it has its issues, this sort of like knowingness and the consistency of that being there sort of has a huge impact on you. And so, I mean, there's several times in the movie where her character is like, I'm not a good person. Like right now I'm thinking about like A, B, C, and D, and I know that makes me horrible. Right. And it's like, yeah, it does. Honestly, it makes you a really shitty person. But at the end of the day,
you're honest about it.
She is honest, and it is probably calculations that a lot of people are unfortunately having. But, you know, there's an interesting moment of juxtaposition in that when, like, the story takes place in New York City. So when we see all the beginning, it's like, of course, like, these are Wall Street dudes. They're talking about, like, oh, I want a guy who's got a minimum salary of $100,000. I'm like, fuck, who the hell's that guy? Like, that's the average that, like, signs up for this dating service. Like, 100 grand is just an easy level of income to achieve. And that you, like, could demand it as part of your dating profile. It's like, when she's having these conversations, both with her clients and with Pedro Pascal's character, never once in those conversations does kindness, consideration, or sense of humor ever come up. It's always mathematics. It's always height, income, attractiveness, sort of niceness, right? So it's very important that that is the case, because the movie, like, there's a point where they're not in the city setting anymore, and they're in like a much more like reserved country setting. And it's like the movie's like Inside Out at that point, where all of the things that sort of mattered in the city don't matter in the same way. And you can kind of see it. So I think the undertones of the movie, the undercurrent, is not so much that it's actually nihilistic. It's that there is kind of a layer of that in places that are sort of the New Yorks and the LAs, where that kind of like image and social status sort of becomes this appealing thing, when in reality, like, all of those things could line up, but the person could still just not be someone that you actually care about. And if you don't care about them, you're never going to. It's not going to just be like, oh, this is, yeah, eventually, like, I'll find the emotion. So I think, honestly, like, it's a cool, like, subversion on Song's part. And I think it's a really, like, smart, interesting follow-up to Past Lives. I do think Past Lives was better, but I think it's a different kind of story. And I'd like the way that Past Lives operates better, but I did have a lot of fun with this. And it feels like it's probably up there in the movies that I like this year. Like, it's in the conversation of making it into, like, the top four or something, but
yeah. I think it's also kind of similar to like when they compare the like it's based, it's like the glasses that you have on, like the rose colored glasses, right? You wear a certain pair of glasses while you're living in the city and that's all you're exposed to. And then you step out of the country and you're like, oh, these things don't into the country. And oh, these things don't actually matter. And now those glasses kind of come off and you're not blinded by those things anymore. Like, you know, especially in New York, like the flashing lights of Times Square is very distracting of like the slot machine of you have to have these kind of boxes checked, or like you got to win the lottery of finding the guy who's got a $200,000 a year salary minimum, certain height, certain like eye color, all of those things when that doesn't actually matter. And I do think that a lot of it has to do with age. And I think they kind of portray that too in this movie, because the ones that didn't really care about that were the ones that were saying they were older versus like the early mid 20 year olds under 30 versus over 30 year olds.
Yeah. When sort of like you live in Manhattan, you guys all go to like a good school, right? And then you're like in law school, you're becoming doctors. Like the notion that, oh, because I'm a lawyer that makes $100,000 a year and I have a good education, that means like my ideal man has to meet all of these like artificial standards that I've put in place. Like he has to also come from like a similarly good family and have gone to a good school. It's sort of like selective breeding, I guess, in that way.
Yeah. And they did it with the men, with the women too. Like the one that was like, I said 20s, not like, or I said older than 21. So she's like, okay, I've got a 39 year old. And he was like, I didn't say in the 30s.
He's like, that's basically 40.
Yeah. That's basically 40. I meant like 27.
Yeah. And then she's like, okay, like what about 33? He's like, no,
that's still in the 30s.
That's still, yeah.
Disgusting. But anyways, you know, like the same.
There's a reason why that guy was single.
Yeah, exactly. And like the unrealistic expectations that people are walking around with of who a partner or a counterpart should look or what part they should play, essentially, like what their character trait should be.
Yeah, like what actually matters in a relationship. And I think the movie does a good job of sort of diluting down to like this is what actually matters, despite sort of the rest of it and the title being materialist. I do think it is like we're using that as a punching bag in this equation.
Yeah. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I didn't see Past Lives, but it kind of makes me want to watch it now.
You would like Past Lives a lot.
I think you said that when you saw it too.
Yeah, I cried. And she won Best Original Screenplay for it, I think. So
hopefully this is in the Oscar conversation.
We'll see. I don't know if it has it will have the juice to get there, but having the Oscar under her belt will definitely help. And there's a lot of stuff. I think Golden Globes, because you could put this as best musical or comedy, and then like it would get some Globe recognition that way. But let's move on. I don't want to get into awards predicting because it's
too early.
People are doing it. It's just, I don't really care. I just, whatever wins. I just want like good movies to be good movies and to enjoy them for the most part. But we went and saw F1, the movie, not to be confused with F1, the sport. But it is a movie.
But it did feel like that.
Yes, it is a movie based on the sport. And this is, of course, Joseph Kosinski, director of Top Gun Maverick and a few other things. But mainly Maverick is sort of like the flagship now.
Which I didn't realize that at first, and it made so much sense when you said it afterwards. I was like, no wonder I was stressed the whole movie.
Yeah, I don't know that I could pick a better director to make an F1 movie, but he also directed Oblivion, which is another Tom Cruise movie, and I do love that movie. But he made Spiderhead too, and I did not care for Spiderhead, so... It's a mix, but I think F1 is like, hey, Kosinski sort of just took Top Gun Maverick and made it about cars, and that's fine. Like, I get it. It's derivative, like the very predictable love story between Kerry Condon and Brad Pitt, you know.
Except for not really. They don't end up together. He still goes on and does what he wants.
Spoiler alert!
Oops. You can delete that. You just said predictable love story. That's a spoiler alert.
Well, predictable love interest.
Okay, take this out.
No, it's too late now.
Just delete it.
it sort of follows the formula of Maverick, and it follows the formula of sort of like a lot of like gunslinger type movies where it's like, oh, the old veteran is, he's the guy who's going to sort of turn things around. It's sort of like it's a sort of a sports movie trope a little bit, where I think we saw it in I think Mr. Baseball is a good example. I think Major League has that, where there's like an old veteran that's important to the team. The one with Woody Harrelson and Andre 3000 and Will Ferrell. I never remember the name of it. The one where they're the tropics. It's the basketball movie. Never remember the name. I'm going to get stuck. I don't want to get stuck.
Keep going.
But yes, this idea that there's like some old veteran player that's going to be the difference maker. I think it feels contrived to people who are movie watchers that are not also sports fans. Because on the one hand, the idea that like a really old athlete is going to step into a prime situation and dominate or even be able to make the court, like you'd never see like a 56-year-old football player in the NFL. Wouldn't happen. Baseball, probably not, but you could play until you're in your 40s in baseball, especially if you're a pitcher. And I mean, hockey, you could play probably until your 40s. LeBron James is our age, right? So he's playing into his 40s. But like to be in your 50s and to have like an impact at a high level is just super, super, super unlikely. But it doesn't mean that there's no value in a guy with that kind of experience. And so it's a matter of sort of getting the audience to not just believe, but to understand why they should believe that a character like Brad Pitt could be valuable in this situation. I think for the most part, the movie does that. Like the 30 years of actual race experience matters in terms of like you're trying to develop a shitty team that loses all the time. So like you bring in someone who has a lot of race experience, and you know, it would that ever happen in real life in F1? No, absolutely not. There's a reason F1 drivers are in their 20s. Most of them are like born into money because it's an expensive sport. So it's kind of like an elitist entry point that way. So it's not really easy. That's the whole thing with like Lewis Hamilton, is that like he had to fight very hard to get where he is. And he was not like silver spoon, like work hard. I think his dad was like working class, you know, blue collar guy. So it's super unlikely that this story is even remotely realistic. But that said, the movie that we get makes it about as believable as I could have hoped for. And honestly, like walking out of the theater, I was like, look, all I knew that the movie was called F1, that Brad Pitt was in it, had seen no trailers, didn't care. I know F1 racing. I'm not like a huge fan, but I've watched it. I know some of the drivers. Like, so I'm like, okay, I'm a little bit of a fan, but not hardcore. So I think for the people who are hardcore fans, to see their sport represented in that way is a big win. For people who are casual fans, you get like a real deep look inside the pit. You get a look inside the garage. You get a look inside the team and sort of all of the aspects that go into like building a car and winning a race and running a team and what it means to compete in that environment. And sort of you see the rookie side of it too, of like he's caught up in the fame and the money and the media of it. So I think from all those aspects, like it's about as good of a representation of F1 as a sport as you could put on film. And they filmed a lot with the real drivers during the real races. They obviously, Kaczynski from Top Gun understood sort of how to capture speed on camera, so it feels fast when you're watching it, which is great because it makes those moments awesome.
Thank God we didn't see that in 4DX.
Right. Talk about bring your seatbelt. But yeah, like it has a great sensation of speed. It looks really good on camera. There's like some fantastic race moments in it too, which sort of like give you an insight into strategy behind even just like drifting and team racing and sort of manipulating the rules a little bit and car building. And it gives you like just enough to where if you don't know anything about F1, you learn something. If you're a casual fan, there's probably still some things that you learned and are more interested in. Then if you're a hardcore fan, it's like they were never going to capture the sport 100%, but given that it's a movie, they did a pretty solid job of it. And yeah, all the drivers were there, like Verstappen, Hamilton, Albon, you know, all these dudes were in the movie. Some of the other team managers were there too. So it's as good as a job of that you could have realistically done.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I was stressed the whole time. I was very invested, and I feel like it was long, but I don't feel like it was drawn out long. I understand. I feel like in order for us to get to where we needed to be for the ending, we needed to go on that whole journey. I don't feel like there was fillers, I guess you could say, in it. I know we were talking to your sister about it, and there's like a couple of things where they should have maybe portrayed something a little bit more, and I agree. But also, we don't know how, like, the 20-year-olds who don't have fear, like, do they all react the same way kind of a thing? It definitely reminded me of Maverick, which is why I was like, oh, that makes sense when you said that afterwards. But, I mean, I thought it was really good.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the thing, is that I saw a funny video today where it was, like, the discourse around F1, and maybe I'll share that on the podcast page, but it's basically, like, a clip from Dune of the two sides arguing, and Javier Bardem's on one of them, and he's like, so what if it, like, rehashes all this stuff? Like, the music is amazing, like, it looked, and the other side is like, but it's derivative, and blah, blah, and so it was really funny, because I'm like, oh, yeah, I totally see both sides of this argument, and
yeah, the music supervision, the
Hans
score,
Zimmer, like, the score is fantastic.
It was phenomenal. It was great. I think, I mean, I didn't personally have any complaints about it. Yeah, I just didn't have any complaints about it. But yeah. I also went in without any expectations. We didn't see a trailer. We just saw the poster. We knew it was F1 and taking your sister because she is that fan.
Yeah.
But honestly, it made me want to watch F1 more.
Yeah.
But I want to
watch. It made me want to drive F1.
Yeah, no. It made me want to watch it, though, from like the camera angle we got in the movie of the driver, which I don't know that they show that a lot.
Well, they do and they don't, because all the cars have that camera. And when I made our little race video for football season, I used some of that, but they don't show that during the broadcast that much, because you don't follow just one driver the whole time. Whereas when here we're following like two drivers. So at max, you're only really switching perspectives twice.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like even for all of the things that, whatever, perceived weaknesses, derivatives, whatever, the execution is so high that I do not care. Like, the movie was enjoyable. The music's fucking awesome. It looks great. Brad is Brad. Kerry Condon's awesome. Bardem, always good. Like, so the stuff that is maybe less than doesn't matter, because the stuff that is good is so good that it's still enjoyable. And it's like, this is the kind of movie that's called like dadcore or something like that. It's like a dad movie, but
I don't get the reference. But
no, this movie made a shit ton of money. It made like $145 million this
already?
Weekend. Yeah. So wow. It's good.
Yeah,
like
it's good.
I get that there's like maybe arguments to be made that like it does sort of not do some original things. But again, like, do you have fun watching the movie? Do you enjoy movies at all? Because if you go into this movie and you're like, I didn't like that, then I don't know what you would want out of an F1 movie that it didn't give you.
Yeah. I think, too, like, yeah, I think, you know, like, it made me cry.
Yeah.
It made me laugh. Like, I always remember when we've talked about the quote-unquote perfect movie, if it makes me feel all the emotions, you're doing something really well.
Yeah, it's got a sense of humor. I feel like the emotion is well balanced. I was white knuckling some of the race moments. I was gasping at some of the cinematography choices. The music was making the hair stand up on the back of my neck. So
did you feel me squeezing your hand a lot?
Of course I did. And I look over and I see you wiping your face. I'm like, oh. It got her.
It got me.
This movie got her. So that's good. But that was the last of the new ones that we saw as a pair. I'm going to run through all of the stuff that I saw solo and give it a quick up or down recommendation. Thumbs up or thumbs down. So one of those was Bring Her Back, which was the follow-up to Talk to Me, the Philippou brothers from New Zealand, I think. I would say thumbs up. solid. I think good follow up to Talk to Me. I liked it better than Talk to Me. So for me, at least, I would definitely say check it out. Tornado is a very interesting movie that, like, I didn't know much about. I just saw, like, a dude with a sword on the cover and saw that it was kind of like samurai stuff. So checked it out. It's going to be hard to find, but it is like part Western, part feudal Japanese samurai story, part swashbuckling adventure. And I would love to see a sequel to it, actually, because it ends in a place where it's like, I think there's a more interesting story to tell now beyond it. I don't know if it'll get there, but it is a lot about like blood and honor and family and stuff like that. 28 years later, I would say, is the other movie that is in the conversation for my like best of the year type of stuff, because that movie, despite it being sort of like a horror movie and in the universe, the third in a franchise of horror films, I feel like it's like very emotionally resonant and more so than it is a horror movie. Like, it does have some like scary stuff in it, but I feel like it's not, it's more of a drama that just happens to take place like in a horror universe. And it really uses the horror genre to amplify the emotional toll. I like tears streaming down my face. Guy next to me, Instagram. I'm just like, course. What are these people doing? It's like, this is the moment in the movie where you should be paying attention and you've already checked out and you're looking at Instagram. So it's like, you're missing like what you came to the movie theater for. So that was the other one on my list of movies that I'm like sobbing and the other person is on Instagram next to me not paying attention. So I think that list is going to continue to grow. But I did also see Ballerina, which is the John Wick spinoff with Ana de Armas. And she's good. The movie, speaking of derivative, is essentially like just John Wick 5 with her instead of Keanu. And then Keanu's still in it in a cameo. So they had to bring him in to like assure the fans that like, no, like this still is a John Wick movie. So it doesn't quite stand alone in the way that it should. Doesn't reinvent the wheel in any way. Pretty much just harnesses all the stuff that you like about John Wick and repackages it with a new lead character. But there is a scene at the end that is like, oh, fuck, I would watch this all the time. Like, this is what sort of the John Wick franchise movies present the opportunity to do, and is just like a gorgeously shot, very entertaining end of the movie. It doesn't make a lot of sense, like when you think about how that would play out, but it looks beautiful on screen and I'm like, okay, it won me over. I was kind of like lukewarm on it, and then by the end I'm like, yeah, I would say thumbs up. Unholy Trinity was Pierce Brosnan, Sam Jackson, and some kid I've never heard of before. And it's a Western, kind of like a revenge Western, but like they're looking for gold. It was okay. I think Pierce and Sam were both good. The kid was all right. But yeah, I think it's a remake of another, of a different movie called Unholy Trinity from, I don't know, like 60 years ago. But if you really like Westerns and you're like a Western purist, then interesting choice. And probably would enjoy it. But if not, I would say probably pass for general audiences. And then the last one I saw was The Phoenician Scheme, which is Wes Anderson's newest. And I think I ultimately did come around to liking it, although I didn't like love it. And when I left theater, I was like, nah, there will probably be a day that comes where I like this movie. But today's not that day. But I feel like objectively, like it has all of the Wes Anderson stuff that I like. You know, great cast, looks good, it's funny. Stylistically, he still uses like miniatures and he uses a lot of different filmmaking techniques. So it's still like, if you like Wes Anderson stuff, you'll probably still like it. If you're not a fan of his, then this is just kind of like more of the same. And I'm kind of like in between, where I've seen all his movies, but I'm not like a hardcore Wes Anderson fan. But I do love like Fantastic Mr. Fox and French Dispatch, I really loved. And then Asteroid City, I didn't really love, but then I did see it a second time. And then when I watched this, Phoenician Scheme made me like Asteroid City a lot better. So maybe the same thing will happen where I'll revisit Phoenician Scheme later and be like, oh, you know what? Like, this grew on me in a way that I didn't expect. It's not bad at all. I couldn't sit here and be like, oh, this is a bad movie. Just whatever it was that day, I was like, yeah, I'm not super into it, but you know, it's still Wes doing his thing. And then this weekend we had what? F1 and Megan was the other big one that came out. Megan 2.0, which did not do very well at the box office. Yeah, I think it totally underwhelmed and made like 14 million.
I mean, shame on them. Well, not shame, but like not smart on their part to release it the same weekend as F1.
Yeah, I mean, totally different audiences, you would think, but
I don't know.
The marketing just hasn't been good. And they're pretty much telling us we're not even in like the horror universe anymore. So the horror fans that maybe wanted to see more of that are just checked out. And
I mean, I think it's been kind of over-marketed in a sense because it's that trailer before the movies at AMC's, at least.
Yeah.
Where she's the theme like they did with some of the other movies. But I still don't think it should have. I don't think they should have done it the same weekend as F1.
For me, the face effects are just not good. Like, the digital face just looks bad. And I'm just like, it should have gotten better after the first one. But it looks like she's wearing like a mask that's constantly sort of like glitching. It doesn't look like the face mapping is very good. And so I don't know why you wouldn't just do like facial prosthetics or something. Because like, I don't know. Just give me Alita Battle Angel 2 for fuck's sake. Like, what do I need to do? James Cameron, are you ever going to be done with Avatar? We need Alita 2, okay? That's what I really want.
That's true. I forgot about that one.
Alita versus Megan. How's that? I'll settle for that if it gets the fucking movie made.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that'll wrap it up. We did talk about like a dozen movies, so.
I think that's good.
Yeah. And then we'll reconvene for this week on the couch over at Hers, His, and Ours, and we'll talk about TV shows and a couple of movies we watched at home.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening, if you're listening.
Thanks for joining, if you're joining.
Cool. Have a good night.
Thank you for tuning back in and for taking the time to listen to this episode. I've got a lot of irons in the fire right now, but I definitely want to get back on track with doing This Week at the Movies because I really love doing it. Kristen and I obviously need to get back on track with doing Hers, His, and Ours. Kunked is the most popular show on the network, and it's hopefully a rising tide that lifts all ships kind of situation, but this was the original show. And then, of course, there's Bad Movies We Love and Ex-Friends. You can find that and all the other shows in the Scheist Podcast Network by looking for ScheistPodNet on Instagram, Blue Sky, and Twitter. And until next time, take care, everybody.